Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
A voice of reason in the medical world. Dr. Fred Brown from Griffin Health talks to Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Dr. Brown, so glad to have you on this morning. And I want to start by talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, of course, because it's now here. But it's very clear it's different than the other two vaccines. So first of all, can you talk to us a little bit about that? The fact that it's a single dose versus two, does it make it less effective? Is it something people should be waiting on and saying, hey, you know what, I'd prefer getting a Pfizer or Moderna, or does it really not matter?
Good morning, Melissa. I hope you're doing well.
Well, you could tell I have a lot of questions on my mind. I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for asking.
Very good. Yes, I knew you would want to know about this, and I know your listeners want to hear about this also. So yes, let me just go a little bit onto the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Okay.
So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is what we would consider a more traditional vaccine. As opposed to the Moderna and the Pfizer, which actually puts this little lipid nanoparticle with mRNA. We talked about that last week, that messenger RNA.
Mm-hmm.
So that instead of doing that, what it does is it commandeers another virus. It's called an adenovirus. It basically takes all the guts out of that virus and puts in a code. And it says, okay, you know, we want this virus to go in, act like it normally would, but it doesn't give you an infection. What it does is it gives you a message to your genetic code and says, make the S protein. So the end product is exactly the same. So
okay.
So either mRNA or Johnson & Johnson, the ultimate goal is to get this spike protein, this S protein actually out in your body and having a response to it. So next time it sees it, it actually responds and you get an immune response. So that's the difference between it. So there's clearly a difference between the two. This one is the one that's actually, if people were concerned about, well, you know, the mRNA is new. Again, we've talked about sort of, yes, but it's the science that's been around. This is the one that we've actually really used, and this is actually, again, what I would consider to be more traditional.
Okay.
It is a one-shot, and the one-shot gives, it looks like from the data, it looks like it's giving about 76% and maybe a little bit more efficacy. So it could be up to 24% likelihood of you getting an infection. That is definitely lower than the Moderna and the Pfizer, which
are
95%.
Right. That's what I think I was looking more at.
Yes. So does that, you know, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know we talked a lot about, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, 95. I've also mentioned several times when I talk to people that, you know, 95% is probably the best vaccine we've ever seen in history.
True.
Typically the influenza vaccine is a lot less.
Yeah, isn't it usually like, I mean, I could be totally wrong, but there have been years where it's like 40% effective, sometimes 60% effective, somewhere
right.
in that range.
Right, absolutely. And that's absolutely correct. What happens is when you have influenza, the more people who actually have the vaccine, the less likely they are going to spread it,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to have a milder case of it, and then that means our vulnerable populations are protected.
Got it.
And that's sort of the important thing. So it goes back to herd immunity. It's great because I can actually talk about all these epidemiology terms and people understand them.
I know. Isn't that so true? Yeah. Yeah, that's so true.
So it comes down to herd immunity. And because mm-hmm. there is no herd immunity for COVID-19 besides what's occurred over the last year,
mm-hmm.
that means more people have to be vaccinated. So it becomes a numbers game. Even though it's 76% as opposed to 95%, the more people that get the vaccine, the less likely it is to spread, because that means more people have some immunity to it. And 76% is still really good.
Right. That's still above, like you said, like a typical flu shot. That's still above mm-hmm. what that would be. And I would imagine, Dr. Brown, and please correct me if I'm wrong. So if, you know, if we do see 70-80% of the population vaccinated with one of these three, does that higher the effectiveness of the Johnson & Johnson? Like if you now have herd immunity, wouldn't that make the shot more effective? Or no?
Yes and no. So in all intents and purposes, we can go with that.
Okay. So, you're like, just so because you're complicated, yes.
Math doesn't quite work that way, but it's okay. We're okay. But no, I think that's a way to understand it, an easier way to understand it. The more people that are vaccinated, it doesn't matter if you have a 76%, because that means that – so to actually get infected by COVID-19, it means you have to come in contact with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you have a room full of people who have COVID-19 and you had the vaccine, right, and you had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you have a 25% likelihood of getting it if you're in this room full of COVID-19.
Right.
But because if everyone is now at 76%, no one's really going to get the virus.
Right.
And therefore, they're not going to spread it. So, yes.
So, in many ways,
that's exactly right.
So, guys, it's totally fine that I skipped certain sciences and math in high school. Everyone was like, how did you get, you know, how did you do that? See, it's fine. I got the math kind of right. Not really.
I think that's really understandable in the way that we want to do it. Again, I think this gives another opportunity for people to, you know, if they are concerned about the Moderna or the Pfizer, now they have another option. The two bonuses related to this is it is actually the more traditional type of vaccine.
Right.
That's one aspect. So, I mean, you could say, well, we've had vaccines before. This is the same thing.
True.
And the second thing is it's a one shot.
You get the
one and you're done.
Yeah.
You know, you get some side effects. It doesn't matter. You don't have to worry about getting the second one.
That's very true. Dr. Brown is here and we're talking about what else COVID. Now, I did notice this morning, Dr. Brown, and I know you and I have talked about this on the show many times. Johnson & Johnson is working very hard to find a children's vaccine. I know Moderna and Pfizer are also working on children's. Right. Now, my understanding from you, and I could totally have misread it, was that kids don't really need the vaccine because they're not reacting to COVID as badly. But is it because that they could spread it? Is that why we're working on a vaccine? And how young do you know these vaccines are going to?
So there's two reasons to have a vaccine for children. One is, actually there's three. One is children become adults. So.
True.
Always.
At some point, they do grow up. It's terrible. Yes.
So you have to be sort of ready for that.
True.
The other thing is that children who have underlying issues, chronic illnesses, diseases. I mean, it's unfortunate we sometimes forget about that. But children that do have, you know, underlying diseases can be at an increased risk.
Mm-hmm.
Immune deficiencies, sickle cell disease.
Right.
All these other things that are horrible in children, but. You know, they make them more susceptible to any type of virus, including this one. So it's sort of in the best interest to get it to continue with that. It is unclear if children are spreaders or not. So having the ability to actually do younger people is good. You know, likelihood that the very young are going to be spreading out is pretty low. But we have seen, you know, sort of that. I'm going to just sort of go a little bit limb, maybe the high school age children who are actually getting it and spreading it. So those are the areas that I think we at least need to go into the adolescents and start vaccinating from that standpoint. Children, because of the same mechanism that we did, if all the adults, another reason to get the vaccine, if all the adults get it, by herd immunity, the children will, there'll be some scattered outbreaks like they would be for flu, but ultimately there wouldn't be this major outbreak that we're seeing now.
Sure. Okay. Well, we'll see how that all ends up turning out, and we'll see how low in age, because that's my question is if it's going to be like toddlers or if we're talking about, like you said, teenagers, it sounds like for sure, which could be super spreader. We've seen that in our high schools for sure. So, Dr. Brown, always my voice of reason. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Melissa. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
So a fun fact you may not have known about our Connecticut Zoo, members of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, like the Beardsley Zoo, take a portion of each entrance fee and set it aside in conservation funds to help support vulnerable species. Now, Greg, what does that mean? So does that mean like when people come to the front entrance, when they come to the zoo, that their money isn't just going back to, you know, certain efforts at the zoo? This is actually like on a bigger scale doing so much more?
Well, so that good morning. It's what we as a conservation organization. We have a goal to also help with conservation efforts, not only within the zoo, but also in other locations. So a portion of every gate receipt goes into a conservation fund, and that conservation fund then will be sitting there, and we will then determine where our funds are needed to go into the conservation efforts around either locally, the United States, or around the world. And so we feel this is important to have this funding there because it is part of what we do here. Our animals do come from other parts of the world. We don't get them from there, but you know, their heritage is from there. So if we can support the wild animals, then we're doing our job for conservation. And that really came to the fore this past month, where we saw the sea turtle issue down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That actually turned out to be, and I don't know, your listeners have probably seen this on Facebook and other things, but this was the largest coal stunning event that's been documented in the United States since 1980.
For anyone who didn't see it, Greg, what are you referring to?
Well, we'll go really quick back. The reptiles are cold-blooded. They're ectothermic, which means they get their heat from their environment around them.
Mm-hmm.
Sea turtles also are ectothermic. They are cold-blooded, and they need a certain temperature of their environment to keep them active and keep them alive. They can have periods of cold. This means their body slows down. Doesn't mean they die, but their body functions start to cease.
Mm.
If there's food in their gut, it doesn't get digested. They get lethargic. Now, if you're a sea turtle and you get lethargic, that's not very good.
Right.
So we had 7,000 that were picked up from the waters around Texas because
of their deep freeze.
Stunning event.
Sure.
Because there was the water temperature dropped below 50 degrees. That's kind of the tipping point for these animals. And they were paralyzed basically floated to the surface. Many died, but many, 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 over 5,000 were rescued.
Wow.
So being that, they were able to be pulled in and brought to locations, a lot of zoos, a lot of aquariums, a lot of animal sanctuaries, mm-hmm. all helped with this effort because 5,000 animals is a lot. These were loggerhead turtles, which can get to be about 4 feet long, green sea turtles, which get to be about 3 feet long, and Kemp's Ridley turtle, which is one of the more endangered species of turtles on the planet, about 2 feet long, were all part of these turtles that go down there to winter and then got into this problem. We were able, along with a lot of our brethren zoos and aquariums, we sent money down through the AZA to help with this because it's a huge Herculean effort.
Yeah.
To keep these animals alive. The idea here is you have to keep them alive. You don't have to feed them, you know, but you have to keep them alive. You have to get them someplace warm and get them back up to speed because the body temperatures have to be increased. The little turtles, of course, will go down faster because their body weight is less, but they'll come up faster.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have all of a sudden, you know, a lot of turtles moving around that are not lethargic anymore but now want to move. So really, it was very lucky or fortunate that the water temperatures got back up pretty quickly. That the swing came back. It wasn't a prolonged cold effect, cold snap, and they were able to get these turtles back into the wild. So
That's
a lot of these
incredible.
Turtles have been released now.
Wow.
But a huge issue. I mean, we won't get into climate change yet, but this is again one of the biggest ones we've seen since 1980, and again, that shows there's swings with the temperature that these animals are not coping with.
Mm-hmm.
And,
sure.
And before we finish, I just want to mention that you know we have these turtles in Long Island Sound in the summertime.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
We have the turtles I just mentioned: loggerhead sea turtle, mm-hmm. green sea turtle, and Kemp's Ridley sea turtle. Again, most endangered of the sea turtles, and even leatherbacks. Sea turtles, which can get to be 8 feet long and weigh over 1,500 pounds. They're
Jeez.
Gigantic. These are all found in Long Island Sound.
Wow.
A couple years ago, I was out on the Sound, and we saw went by something. Didn't even know what we were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Turned around, came back, and it was a sea turtle that had been hit by a boat.
Oh, my gosh.
And I jumped overboard, and I went over to try to grab it, but it was one of the loggerheads, and again, about 450 pounds. It was strong enough to where I could not do anything for it.
Yeah.
So at that point, what you do is we just couldn't do anything for that animal. I think it subsequently did perish from a boat strike, and that is one of the biggest problems we have in Long Island Sound with sea turtles, is that power boats really can't see them, and if they're basking on top of the water, getting warm,
they're at risk.
Getting that heat into
yeah.
them, they can get hit.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I just want to end up with these are animals that we do have in Long Island Sound. They've been more prevalent over the past 5 years, which is a great sign that our Long Island Sound is getting more healthy. We've had whales there. We've had all kinds of sea creatures that are coming in. But again, with that happening, we do have that interaction with humans and animals. Mm-hmm. So if you see a sea turtle on the beach or in the water struggling, you can call Mystic Aquarium. Mystic Aquarium is the program, AZA institution that is licensed to work with marine animals, sea turtles and ants and whales and dolphins and seals. They are the ones that you call if you see one that looks like it's in trouble. Okay. And they do have a team that goes out to work with that. Also, you can join and become part of that group. They have training that you can become not a rehabber. You really can't. You come out and you can assess for them because, again, this is a really big deal. A lot of animals can be washed on shore.
Yeah.
So if you see something, you could be trained for that, and you could help them, secure the animal, keep people away,
cool.
and then wait for their team to get there to help. So
that is awesome.
If people are interested in that, look at Mystic Aquarium's website. It's very cool, and it's something I think people can get part of, which, again, helping all the animals that we have around our area.
Yeah, very interesting stuff, Greg. And I just love the fact that people, as soon as they walk in the entrance of the zoo, a portion of your entrance fee is going to conservation efforts like Greg was just talking about. So thanks for sharing that, Greg.
We helped the sea turtles this year. We've gone with golden lion tamarins in South America. So, we feel, again, we're doing that with the help of our guests, and we thank the guests for being part of that.
That is so cool. Greg, thank you so much for sharing that. That's really awesome. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too. Yeah, Queen, we all feel under pressure. I think we all can relate. So when you're feeling under pressure or many other things that make us anxiety-ridden or overwhelmed, the question is, how do we kind of deal with being overwhelmed? It's a great question. It's something we can all relate to. And I'm so glad that Stephanie Swantek is here this morning to talk about it. She is with the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare in Milford. And good morning to you, Steph. First of all, what does it even mean, really, to be overwhelmed? Like, what is your body going through when it's overwhelmed?
So my definition is just that we're taking on too much. Something is out of your control, and so that creates that feeling of anxiety, of lack of I don't know what to do, and physically and physiologically, what it does even to our brain is basically our frontal cortex is where we make our decisions. We're able to assess risk. It kind of basically blacks that part out. Same thing if you're like basically consuming substances, and it immediately turns our body into kind of that flight or fight mode, which kind of creates like tension, or I don't know, or maybe you say something that you didn't mean to say, or you're really irritable, or et cetera.
So not to complicate, because I think we all kind of have, well, I know we've all related to being overwhelmed before, but Steph, I think there's like a difference when something arises and you're like, whoa, I'm overwhelmed by my workload, or whoa, this conversation's very overwhelming, or oof, this situation is a little overwhelming. How do we know, like, when we don't, it becomes like a gray area for some people where you live overwhelmed most of your life versus moments that trigger you being overwhelmed. Does that make sense how I'm saying that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, again, we're right. Like, what culture do we stem from? Right.
Right.
And that's go, 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 succeed, succeed, do more. And that means that we are living a plentiful life. But at the end of the day, if we're not feeling calm, and we can't make decisions and breathe and slow down and be in control of that, again, at what degree are we living at?
Exactly. And I think, too, for example, not to use myself, it's not all about me, but I think sometimes it's easier just because I know myself pretty well. I've been stuck with myself for quite some time now. I can't get rid of me. I have found there are times where people will recognize I'm overwhelmed, but I don't see it. So where I'm biting off more than I could chew, or I'm juggling 16 things with only two arms and I don't see it. Like, I feel like I'm sleeping okay. I feel like I'm eating okay. I'm not snapping at anyone. I don't think I'm being mean to anybody, but other people recognize, hey, like, this girl's overwhelmed. How do we recognize when we are actually overwhelmed? Because sometimes, you're right, there are those jarring, like, stomach pains, headache, oh my gosh, I think I could just collapse right here on the floor. That does happen sometimes. But I bet you, Steph, and I'm sure you've seen this yourself, that there are people who don't even know they're overwhelmed and they keep taking on more and more.
Right. And I think too, in that regard, when we're just in overdrive consistently, mm-hmm. at some point we will run out of batteries, right? We will burn out. It's physically impossible to go in overdrive consistently. So I guess the question is, if you or someone that was in constant overdrive, if they actually went for a day, turned their phone off, you know, and literally went and completely unplugged, how would that feel for that person? Would that increase their anxiety, or that, like, oh, this feels really nice? Like, this is what I should feel like. I actually feel a little bit of tension because I feel different. And yeah, knowing those differences in your body and then applying them if it's possible.
That's so true. So how do we prevent hitting that wall, like you said, like running out of gas? How do we prevent that?
So I mean, these are kind of stereotypical, but knowing how to say no and not feeling guilty to say no. But I know that's so much easier said than done.
It's so hard.
I'm
so bad at that. Yes.
Yes, and we all are. And mm-hmm. even especially, quote-unquote, as women, you know, constantly needing to say yes, or, oh, yeah, I can just do that quick thing. Oh, yeah, sure, I can help you out. Mm. You know, not comparing yourself, because if you actually are feeling overwhelmed, anxious, nervous, not feeling, like, don't compare yourself to others, because something that maybe you may feel nervous about or you're overwhelmed with may not feel the same, but don't compare our experiences. We come from different places.
True.
But yes, it's paying attention to your body, paying attention to your habits. You know, are we just going through the motions, or do you actually remember what we're doing and intaking our day and being there? Like, are we being present for ourselves and for those around us? Or are we, like, again, moving, going, kind of checking off that list and not even remembering, oh, yeah, I did see that person there. Oh, yeah, I did do that. Or, you know, oh, what was the highlight of my day? I don't even remember.
Right. Yeah. It seems like you got to set boundaries, which is like what you're saying. And you know, in for example, something you had just mentioned a few minutes ago, Stephanie Swantek of the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare this morning. You know, you had mentioned, like, walking away from your phone, for example, for a day. I know for myself, it's funny because we should do that. Honestly, every person should do that. Even if they convince you that they shouldn't, they should. It's literally not natural. Like, if you look back, you know, years and years and years, decades, centuries ago, like, cell phones did not exist at one time, nor did computers. That's because it's not natural for us to be
right
on technology all the time. But that's just the way we've become. That being said, you know, I think we, like, even though overall we are overwhelmed in that moment, if I forget my cell phone, for example, at home and I go to the grocery store, I go into panic. I'll think, oh my gosh, what if the people who never call me are going to call me today? Like, what if today is that day that I get that phone call or whatever? But if you ride it out, and I don't know if you have any advice on this, ride out the anxiety for about 10 minutes and you'll find that actually there's something really great on the other side, which is relief, and you could breathe a little bit better. I don't know if you could talk to that a little bit.
So you said relief and also release, right? Like relinquishing, like, that phone or that whatever that may be does not have power over me. I have power over it, and I don't need it, right?
Exactly.
I give it power.
Exactly.
And in addition to, you know, the other thing is, right, if we do unplug, even if we forget it, where we don't have it for an hour, and then we go back and we have 1,000 messages, the more we're able to not be by our phones for that hour, for that day, whatever that may look like for you, the more the people that are constantly contacting you will understand, oh, yeah, you know, that's Melissa. she'll get to me when she gets to me, because the more you respond, the quicker that they expect that response rate.
So it's okay to change your habits at this point. Like, if people know, hey, this girl usually always picks up and now she doesn't, they're going to eventually, they'll adjust.
If those people are meant to be in your life and those are, like, healthy relationships, then it should adjust, right? That's okay. How relationships should work. They should work with you to complement where and meet you where you're at in that moment.
Yeah. Well, Stephanie, I think you have amazing tips. You've got great guidance for people who struggle in this area because, let's face it, we all get overwhelmed. How can people contact you if they want to talk to you more about this?
Absolutely. So I'm again at Bridges Healthcare, 475-202-2827. And I can just add, Melissa, too, like, simple things too, like even like not drinking coffee or lowering your caffeine intake.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, like, that will lower some anxiety and feeling kind of anxious. And then just really just saving your energy and applying where it needs to go, not where people are telling you where it should go.
Yeah, I love that. Stephanie Swantek, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much. And we'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you. Have a beautiful week.
Thanks. You too.